Lecture 20, Secular Knowledge, the Idea of University.
I would be disinclined to refer to any age in the West as dark after 800 AD, which is why in the previous lecture I was prepared to use that description for the period 650 to 800. And if I paused and stammered and stopped at 800, it's for a very good reason. Because at 800, Charlemagne takes center stage. It is regrettable that we don't spend more time in our teaching on Charlemagne and on precisely what he accomplished. The record here is spotty, and of course so much legend surrounds Charlemagne that sometimes it's quite difficult to tease out the fact from the epic. He's born in 742, his birthplace uncertain. Charlemagne would succeed Coloman in 771 as king of the Germanic Franks. He was a great and good Christian man. We're all taught that in school. I don't recall having been taught that all of his five wives were also good Christians. His administration focused on the needs of the poor and the protection of the church. His kingdom was divided into counties, each jurisdiction with its bishop and mayor, with emissaries from his court responding to him regularly on the state of security in each region. His capitulara missorum was a royal mandate that secured protections not seen again until Magna Carta three centuries later. Here's a document and here's a king guaranteeing certain protections for the people. We're getting very close to the idea of rights, perhaps not the American Bill of Rights, but again, not bad for 800. We know, too, that one of his edicts required that the problem of illiteracy be addressed, and that schools, little abbey schools, undertake the task of teaching people, teaching them how to read and write, although there's some evidence to suggest that Charlemagne himself never mastered writing. He had some ability in Greek, more in Latin, but his own general literacy was, shall we say, below current SAT standards. He was an extraordinary military leader, personally leading more than 50 campaigns, and in the end, Christianizing nearly all of what today would be called the nations of Europe. He may never have had more than 5,000 men in arms at any given time, but his personal courage and leadership rendered them one of the most effective forces in the history of warfare. He made military service the prerequisite for property ownership, and otherwise made civic duty the foundation of daily life. In a manner of speaking, I'm inclined to think of Charlemagne as one who would have been very good as a Roman emperor. I have no expert knowledge of Charlemagne's military strategies and tactics, but his ruthlessness in combat finds few equals. He ordered the beheading of more than 4,000 pagan Saxons in a single day, this making clear to all what would be visited on those who destroyed Christian churches. And the effect of such measures can only be imagined. So if you wanted to be sure that your Christian church was kept in good repair, Charlemagne is probably the sort of fellow you would want controlling the realm. In the later years of his reign, there is little evidence of Charlemagne's rule being punctuated by military engagements. There were important military events and the like, but in fact, he was able to stabilize the European continent and to a very considerable extent integrate these diverse peoples through skill, through some maneuvering, very capable emissaries, and a plan. A plan that he does not set down for us in explicit and scholarly prose, but a plan nonetheless. It was on November 28 in 800 that he knelt before the Pope and permitted his own temporal rule to be validated by the Church. In a matter of days and weeks, nothing less than a Holy Roman Empire now replaced what had been a mere assortment of principalities jealously and provincially governed for decades by tribal chieftains. In this same measure, Charlemagne established royal rule on a religious foundation. The rights of kings now understood to be, of all things, divine. So the answer to the Trivial Pursuit question, trace out the history of the idea of the divine right of kings, well, I think you've got a fair chance of being correct, saying it begins with Charlemagne. It was in 787 that a truly amazing order was issued under the heading Capitulara de Litteris Collandis, requiring the clergy to use their facilities to teach reading and writing to members of the community. These are the words that matter most in this Capitulara. Quote, "Take care to make no difference between the sons of serfs and freemen, so that they may come and sit on the same benches to study grammar, music, and arithmetic." Here then is Charlemagne. He rules by the authority of this great hegemonic Christian church that has begun to articulate its canonical teachings. Now, militarily, politically, and economically, he needed no pope to establish himself as the unopposable leader in the part of the West he occupied, but in joining crown and cross, he achieved a certain spiritual and transcendental authenticity equal to anything that might be claimed by the sons of Islam. This is a momentous chapter in the history of Western civilization. I say that it is not taught with great vim and regularity is a disappointment. He will unite the West further by instruction, by generous laws, by the fuller participation of the church in daily life. His own reforms include medical training, as well as measures to increase literacy. Recognizing that cohesion comes about in large measure as a result of a common language, or at least a language that allows different peoples to communicate with each other on fundamental matters, Latin will again be the official language for the business of court, for legal documents that might involve people separated by hundreds of miles, for transactions involving property and territorial boundaries, etc. Those who object to contemporary lawyerly documents that seem filled with Latin expressions, again, if you want to blame someone, this is long after Justinian. Charlemagne is the one who's putting all this on the map. For this, of course, teachers are needed, and Charlemagne will recruit them from England and Ireland, the latter really saving civilization by preserving the best of the classical sources. And he obtains a very good Latinist and a great man from Britain. Quote, "Alcuin was my name. Learning I loved. Those who would have mercy on me, pray for my immortal soul." Close quote. Good and largely forgotten Alcuin, born about 735, and with Charlemagne, among the most influential figures in the restoration of scholarship in the Western world. Now, Alcuin had already distinguished himself as the founder of schools and a great library in York. On an official visit to Rome, he would meet Charlemagne in Parma and be enticed to leave Britain for the great projects that this great king envisaged. With Charlemagne's patronage and as head of the palace school, Alcuin was able to influence the educational initiatives that brought literacy to the European clergy and many in their flock. The palace school was at Aachen, which was Charlemagne's favorite court, and it wasn't long after Alcuin's arrival there in 782 that the king and his wife and sister sat as his students. Needless to say, the entire nobility of the realm got the message, and soon it was widely understood that learning itself was a source of status. By the time of his death, schools at every level and throughout this now vast Western Empire were staffed by Alcuin's former pupils. Thanks to the preservation of classical scholarship by the Irish of Iona and their kindred spirits in Britain, there were foundational subjects available to these teachers. the modest abbey schools now would benefit from instruction by informed minds and a carefully crafted curriculum. Shared learning is part of a shared culture. The ancient Greek sense of paideia is what pulls a people together. What it means to be a Hellene is to attach oneself to Hellenic paideia. Alcuin the Latinist and classicist realized that the way you pull diverse peoples together is under the blanket of a culture of learning. He determined the core liberal arts subjects that would prepare a teaching clergy, and they in turn would then bring a more limited set of subjects to bear on the task of elevating literacy throughout the realm. The basic subjects, the three comprising the trivium, grammar, rhetoric, and logic, would evolve and expand over the decades and centuries following the era of Charlemagne and his trusted educator. In time, some of these abbey schools became so popular that monasteries would form near them, occupied by the teaching orders. Now, this is a long, variegated, and wonderful story told all too briefly here. It is sufficient to say that in that course of time, still other subjects were added, such that by the 12th century, there will be seven, the trivium and the quadrivium, the other four being arithmetic, music, geometry, and astronomy. And these come down to us as what? They come down as the seven liberal arts, summarized in 1141 by Hugo of St. Victor. And the abbey schools are now appearing in a rather different manifestation. First at the great cathedral in Paris, where as a result of an application to Rome, the assembly of students is constituted as something called a universitas. Now, I do want to pause at this point and say something about this word. We all refer to colleges and universities, the collegium and the universitas, and we generally think of deans, and at least in America, at least 25 vice presidents, etc., etc. The term universitas refers to what actually begins as a guild of students assembled for the purpose of, not only the purpose of deriving instruction from a good faculty, but being able to bring some pressure to bear to make sure that the education they get is a good one. So what we have now is the founding of the university, at least in the modern sense in which we would talk about universities. It is true that Bologna and Salerno earlier were teaching specialized subjects in law and medicine, but here at Paris we have what today's academic probably would recognize as a liberal arts university. Perhaps one who has labored in academe's weeded groves for many decades may be forgiven for doting on the founding of the university. I will try to control myself, but I should think that the character of the modern university provides about all the control I need. Let me do go back to the founding of the earliest universities, which do seem to be perhaps a little bit better in the breed than these much later manifestations. These institutions were veritable engines of self-perfection. If you had to point to an institutional means by which to carry through the kind of contemplative life that Aristotle had in mind, that is, life on the Isle of the Blessed, where one devotes oneself to contemplation of first things for the sake of keeping company with what is best and most worthy. I say, if you set out to do this in an institutional way, this is what a university is capable of supporting and sustaining and promoting and guiding. You might say, well, what about a religious institution? These are, no double entendre intended, of transcendental importance. But when we talk about a contemplative life, this must include the critical, rational resources of a rational being, those very critical resources inevitably taking a skeptical turn, even a cynical turn, turns in the direction of incredulity, mystification, confusion, ambiguity, irresolution. The process of self-perfection is not a cakewalk. It is a struggle, a daily struggle, By the time you've surrendered your wits to the truth of a revealed religion, that part of the struggle is pretty much over. Now the question is, can you live your life according to the teachings of that faith? Now, I don't want to suggest that the academic life is in any way superior to the religious life. I'd be inclined to think that it doesn't even measure up to it. I want to emphasize that it's a different life. I would submit here, perhaps disclosing my now encrusted academic nature, that the self-perfectionist institution, at the end of the day, is the university institution. It's why it's so absolutely deplorable when these places are turned into trade schools whose essential mission is to find some way of getting their students jobs when they're finished. There should be a series of lectures, I think, perhaps hosted by the teaching company, on the idea of a university, the subtitle perhaps being, "Will It Ever Be Recovered?" But the original university also had its practical mission and its practical orientation. It was on earth, after all. It had to prepare people skilled in the law, skilled in rhetoric, able to handle documents, engage in transactions, and take a proper place as preachers and teachers and priests and emissaries. So I don't want to say that the medieval university begins off the ground and floating like La Pata. No, it has its practical functions. But I should contrast the University of Paris with the older institutions directly committed to such practical considerations as law and medicine. I've mentioned the schools at Bologna and Salerno in Italy, which were devoted to professional training. These do predate the university. So the world already had made provision for specialized technical training, such that graduates could go out and actually do things and engage in the practical affairs of late medieval life. The University of Paris, and those modeled on it, had a rather different set of objectives. The objectives were scholarly objectives, the weighing and sifting of arguments and evidence, the constant confrontation of one scholar before a group of students, all of them having read the sentences of Peter Lombard or some other worthy work, some philosophical work. Students were having to listen to disquisitions on this, ask just the right questions, submit themselves to examination, construct their own glosses on these works. This was done corporately and collectively. It was done communally, within a community of scholars, each of whom had equal moral standing to raise a question, ask for a clarification. You might be interested to know that during much of the early history of the university, chaps who were in my line of work were paid by the lecture. And indeed, in most places, they were paid after the lecture, not before. This might have a quite salutary effect on higher education today. I'm thinking of any number of colleagues who might be cranked up to an almost room temperature if the evening meal would either be bought or not bought on the basis of how well that particular lecture went. The students, in a manner of speaking, unionized or formed a guild. This is the original acceptation of universitas. It was their way of dealing with town-gown tensions. The universities, and Paris itself, from the earliest time, also became rather bureaucratized. The university as a bureaucracy was not invented in the late 20th century. But I think it's to the credit of some of the great scholars of the University of Paris that when they saw these bureaucratic measures gaining a near hegemony, when they saw that government and local ordinances were militating against the free and full expression of an academic life, well, they packed up and left. Now, where did they go? Well, they wanted to find, my tongue being in my cheek is visible, they wanted to find just the right place to have a university, if I may say so. Perhaps I do have prejudices in this regard. So they got on their boats and they crossed the channel and they trundled through Londinium or one of these other weird Roman outposts that had been fought for with the Picts and Celts and Danes and Vikings and all that. And they picked one of the great patches on planet Earth. They picked that place where the Isis and the Thames merge, a busy market town called Oxenford, which came to host the University of Oxford. And great things would happen from a very early date, and I am inclined to say they still do. Now, these developments signal the appearance of a genuinely academic class of philosophers, persons whose lives are devoted to a disciplined and systematic form of study, persons who bring under the protective cowl of the university young and impressionable students who, if shaped and inclined in the right way, will improve the world in virtue of intelligence and decency and good judgment, all this brought to bear on the affairs of a world otherwise crude and vulgar. So the answer to the question, how did all good things happen between 1200 and the 20th century in health, science, jurisprudence, moral philosophy, urban planning, how did all this come about, can't be answered in a single word. But there's only one single word that isn't a laugher when you attempt to answer a question that large. And that word is the university. It is the place that invents the method of invention, the place established specifically to criticize its own core precepts and claims. It is the exercise of a rational creature's refining himself, and refining himself in the kilns of debate and disagreement, rhetoric, inquiry, guidance, philosophical introspection. Well, if I have not satisfied my academic colleagues the world over with this little speech, nothing will. This is to say that, on the whole, universities really are places worth having. But this is only one of the great achievements of that period rather derisively referred to as medieval. This derisively referred to period called medieval has created the university. Between 1150 and 1300, it will also create over 100 Gothic cathedrals in Europe and Great Britain. Now, Gothic cathedrals are not just big churches. They are technical marvels. They are extraordinary creations by any standard. They are engineering marvels. It's quite interesting that the architects of these churches are often unknown. There are exceptions to this. The cathedral at Cluny, for example, has a little motto, "Eis libertis hoc facit." That's to say, "Jis libertis made this." And what is referred to here are little emblematic angels ornamenting a massive facade. So Libertus here has this little plaque that says, if you like these little angels, I did these. But again, the view inspired by the Gothic cathedral is skyward, it's upward, it's toward heaven. And contrast this now, well, these are comparisons that are not meant to be at the cost of either. But contrast this with the paintings of Giotto early in the Quattrocento, the Kiss of Judas, for example, as Judas and Jesus face each other. Here what we have is the human dilemma, human character and personality presented in all of its earthly, even earthy complexity. Just look at the weight of the two figures in the Giotto painting. Look at the gravity that pulls man down to his earthly condition. The view inspired here is surely not skyward. But the medieval perspective is one of service to a higher end. The Renaissance perspective is not indifferent to this, but it begins with an understanding of oneself and one's place in the actual world that is different. The medieval world of knights and serfs expresses an idea of the person as a servant of the Lord, and the Lord can be the Lord of the manor. It is not, however, predicated on the serf as an inferior being. It's predicated on the assumption that each person has a part and a place to take in the great scheme of things. The animating idea of the medieval period is an idea of harmonious and cyclical occurrences and reoccurrences. In the divine order of things, everything does have its part to play. We have actual writings declaring that, "As I am the servant of the Lord of the manor, my Lord is the servant of the Lord." So the sense of a line of authority expresses a divine plan. God's will works its way through the life of every human being. One who is the Lord of the manor is there for the same, if inscrutable, reasons that another finds himself a serf on the same feudal estate. Serfs, it should be noted, had rights, including the right to bring his lordship to court for abuse. And at least occasionally, serfs won these legal contests. The lord of the manor, in turn, had his special duties, as did clergy, the knights errant, the village communities arising on the periphery of great estates. And the message to all is that it is the faithful servant's task to preserve that good order and to promote what is most worthy within it for the greater glory of God. The 19th century aesthete who helped restore respect for the Gothic was John Ruskin. In The Stones of Venice, he writes about late Renaissance architecture with its line and angle, precision, and he contrasts this with the Gothic, declaring it to be, he takes the high Renaissance compulsion to get every little jot and tittle right. He describes it as reminding him of, quote, the servile ornamentation of the Ninevite. Ruskin's point is that the high Renaissance takes an average person of mediocre ability, teaches him one thing to do, and has him do it over and over again, rosette after rosette after rosette, producing boring little figures that might just as well be put on a roll of wallpaper. The line and angle symmetry of the so-called High Renaissance buildings is, on Ruskin's account, at the expense of human freedom. The Gothic, on the other hand, with all of its ostensible imperfections, Gothic, after all, is a derisive term, with all of its seeming grossness and mythic absurdities, is a full expression of the free imagination in devotional commitment to the divine. The Gothic cathedral is a rhetorical statement. It's a statement that at once captures mystery, truth, power, scale, proportion, beauty, ambiguity. Does it make us feel small? Yes, but only in relation to the divine. And we can look up toward the divine, beyond those marvelous colored and pictured windows that again provide us with all the symbology we need to know the truth behind the symbol. Well, I think we surely would want to be respectful toward the institution of the university and would hope to display good taste and say that even if the Gothic isn't one's cup of tea, these cathedrals do warrant admiration and even the occasional visit. But you might draw the line at this third great institutional creation of the medieval period, chivalry. Now, the Roman de la Rose was an epic poem composed over a period of centuries, serving as the metaphor of an essentially romantic and, yes, sexual liaison that culminates in the rose being plucked. There is within it exquisite attention to detail, its place within the garden and the flowers that surround it. Is this not a piece, you might ask, of that great frippery shop that just is medieval Europe? The knight-errant with his preposterous manners, his fine cape laid down across the muddy patch, lest his lady's shoe be soiled, not to mention those incredible jousting matches where men, otherwise intelligent men, mount horses and proceed to kill each other in the interest of gaining, if not love, then at least a lady's veil or handkerchief. Could such a King Arthur and Round Table really ever have existed? And what was the point of all this, and how did it bear on what we are pleased to call the problem of conduct? Well, first, it's important to identify the chivalric knight as essentially a secular priest. He is the executive branch of a government at the top of which is the church itself, the repository of that rational and divine template that should govern the work of the world. Right reason is the reason of the church because directly inspired by God. And the reason of God must now express itself through a willful, faithful, and iconic medium who is the knight errant, one who does God's bidding as this bidding is interpreted through the rational and pastoral resources of Holy Mother Church, and in behalf of the populace at once vulnerable and easily led astray. In this we have the arrangement of what Plato argued was the nature of human nature itself, a soul, a tripartite collection of elements, the rational, the passionate, the volitional, akin as well to the Holy Trinity, a unity within diversity. It features ritualized sacrifice as a form of nobility. The knight's politeness symbolizes his strength, for he is reserved and retreating by choice. He has complete control of his emotions, which is why he can serve any one of the causes of justice. The only insult is an insult to honor. Chivalry is one of the great civilizing influences in the history of Western civilization.